Well, it's lovely to be here. I'd like us to, although this isn't really going to be a workshop, it's not going to be a lot of meditation, I'd like us to just start by doing a few minutes of quiet sitting and just arriving. So I invite you to find a way to sit that will be comfortable for you, that will be sufficiently upright for you to feel alert and comfortable enough for you to feel stable. So when we meditate, we're shifting our attention. We're shifting our attention to what's happening in our experience now. And the simplest way to do that is to feel the body touching the floor, touching the seat at your feet and your bottom, and having a sense that we're making a journey with our attention from the head, where we look out through our eyes, into the body. Just imagine that we're traveling down the body till we come to those sensations of touch and contact where we rest our weight, and sensing. So not thinking about the contact, just sensing it. And noticing that we're breathing. Feeling the rise and fall of breath. Again, sensing, not thinking about those sensations. And noticing also the thoughts and the feelings that are present. And just asking whether our experience feels complex, and where are the elements of our experience that feel simple? Simple sensations, simple awareness, simple knowing of our experience. And in these ways, we make a transition from all of the things we have been doing to the experience of being here now and engaging in this activity. So the bell signals another transition to just moving a little, opening our eyes, coming into the space. So I want to just lead a meditation because it's a good way to start a talk, just to settle, to be here. Also, the little themes I introduced, I mean, I don't know, if you're an experienced meditator, when someone is leading a meditation, you probably, years since, stopped listening to what they actually say. But I did mention just ways of knowing our experience that aren't thinking about our experience. And using the mind's capacity to know, to understand, to experience, to be present. And that's going to be a core theme of the talk. And there is a connection between that and simplicity, which is the theme of the whole festival. Finding what's simple within complexity. And I think that is the direction that mindfulness takes us in. Finding what's simple when things feel complicated. So that's part of the title of my talk. And the other part is mindfulness of sacred simplicity. That word sacred And that's a signal. It's sort of a bit of rhetoric, really. And I'm not wedded to the word sacred. But it's indicating that I think what we're dealing with mindfulness is, and this is whether we're engaging with it in a Buddhist context or a, quote, secular context, we're engaging with the mind and the mind's capacities. And those capacities are not limited in the ways that either we may think or the ways that they're often framed by the way that mindfulness teaches, mindfulness teaching is set up in secular contexts. We're dealing with the mind and its powers, its capacity to know and its capacity to transform and heal. And the word sacred is an indication of that. So I will be talking a little bit about mindfulness in secular settings, but I will not be talking about secular mindfulness. I used to, but I no longer do, because I no longer think that it's accurate to call mindfulness either secular or, in fact, sacred. Mindfulness is the healing power of the mind, the mind's capacity to know. So I'm going to be exploring this, and I as I've been preparing the talk, I what's present in my mind is work that I'm doing at the moment. I'm doing quite a lot of work in prisons, in with men on probation, and that's quite a big thing for me at the moment. It's quite a powerful experience doing that. And that's also led me to reflect on, well, what are we engaging with when we're teaching in that sort of setting? It can't be Buddhism, not if you're being paid by HM Prison and Probation Service. But does that limit it? So I'm imagining that here in this room, and maybe I'll even ask, there are a number of Buddhists. Hands up if you're a Buddhist. Right. Are there any mindfulness teachers here? Oh, okay. I thought there might be more. Yeah. I'm familiar in these discussions with, let's take a step back. So, as Loka Bandhu said, my background is as a Buddhist teacher and practitioner for many years. And over the last 10 years, I've been teaching mindfulness in secular settings and contexts. And over that time, actually over the last 10 years, I've seen it go from something that was fairly peripheral. I mean, there are so many alternative things in these fields, and they mostly sit on the edge of society. And I've seen mindfulness be one thing. It's not the only thing, but it's a very striking example of something that's come right into the health service, the education system. The work we were doing in Parliament was around how can public policy support what's already happening as a grassroots movement that's already touching millions of people. In this country and in other countries around the world. So something quite dramatic has changed as mindfulness has come out of its Buddhist origins, out of those Buddhist precincts, into every other precinct that you can think of, really. Organizations, workplaces, Google, Apple, da-di-da-di-da. And of course that raises lots of questions. Is something lost? Or is it changed? Or is it possible to only extract a certain element which does fundamentally change the meaning of mindfulness from what it was in a Buddhist setting? Or can we think about this differently? So really, I'm going to be opening that up and trying to offer my own way of thinking about this. And I know that some Buddhists, many Buddhists, are wary of mindfulness in those secularized settings. We know what it means for us to practice as Buddhists, but on how on earth can we take it seriously if it's being delivered as an intervention by teachers or well-being practitioners or HR professionals, etc. So, my way of doing this is going to be by talk. I'm going to start with a Buddhist story, a story of Angulimala, which those of you who are Buddhists, and quite a lot of hands went up before, probably heard of. It's one of the most famous stories in the life of the Buddha. So Angulimala, and I'm going to tell it fairly briefly, but there are a few salient points that I want to draw out. Angulimala was a murderer. And you can see the relevance to the prison work. I actually have got to know quite a lot of murderers recently. But Angulimala was a mass murderer who'd killed hundreds of people. There was he had a garland around his neck with a finger from each of his victims. Angulimala means finger necklace. So he lived in the forest outside a town, and forest in those days was badlands, the realm of bandits and wild animals. If you went into the forest, you were in danger, and just simply traveled through the forest en route to another town, because the trade route took you there, meant that you were in danger of attack. So Angulimala, for reasons I won't go into, killed anyone who went down this particular road. And the king sent the army in to sort him out as a terrorist, I suppose you could say, and the army didn't come back. Angulimala killed them all. So that's the story. That's the setup. And so the Buddha arrives in the locality where Angulimala is active, and he finds everyone is terrified. So what does he do? And the answer is he starts walking into the forest. Quietly, one foot in front of another, not hurrying, he just walks into the forest. Everyone tells him, they try to stop him. They say, don't do this. We value you. You're our holy man. Don't do this. You will die. He just keeps walking. He comes into the forest, and eventually, this is a short version, so I won't do the creepy trees and the spooky shadows, but I'll allow you to imagine them. And yes. So he's walking, and Angulimala spots him. And there's a whole scene, like in action movies, you have a tooling up scene. They get all their stuff. There's a tooling up scene in the Angulimala Sutta. And Angulimala tracks the Buddha and then starts to run towards him. And according to the Sutta, the Sutta is the ancient account of the incident in the Buddha's life. According to the Sutta, Angulimala ran as fast as he could, and the Buddha just kept walking. But rather than catching the Buddha, no matter how quickly the Buddha Angulimala ran, and no matter how slowly the Buddha walked, the distance between them never decreased. And Angulimala simply could not understand what was happening. And he shouted, stop, shaveling, stop! I'm running and you're walking. Stop! I cannot catch you! And the Buddha says, I have stopped, Angulimala, having abandoned hatred towards living beings. You, however, have not abandoned hatred towards living beings, and you have not stopped. So Angulimala stops, having been dumbfounded by this. And Buddhist tradition classifies this as a miracle, the Angulimala miracle. And in different traditions, there are various explanations. The Chinese say the earth expanded under the Buddha, and it contracted under Angulimala. In that way, although they were expending different amounts of energy, the distance between them was never closed. So that's the commentarial tradition in China. I prefer, and actually I think this is a bit more of a standard Buddhist tradition, approach, to see this as a kind of a metaphor. Actually, it's not a kind of a metaphor, it is a metaphor, isn't it? It's a metaphor. They're enacting out in their bodily behavior the difference between them in their minds. The Buddha has stopped in the sense that he's no longer chasing after things outside himself to make him happy or to satisfy an inner sense of loss or lack or unhappiness. He's not bothered about that anymore. He doesn't need anything. He, in a sense, he doesn't even mind if Angulimala kills him. Angulimala is driven by something. What? Well, actually, in the stories, we're given various explanations, but that's not really the what Buddha focuses on. He focuses on the fact that where that's left, what that's left Angulimala with, is anger and hatred. And so he's looking to satisfy the pain that's beneath that anger and hatred through killing. And in that sense, he hasn't stopped. He's driven. He's acting compulsively. He's killed hundreds of people, so that is compulsive. And Angulimala is dumbfounded not only by the enactment of the difference between him and the Buddha. He's dumbfounded now by the Buddha's words. And he understands clearly that there's something in him that's driving him forward. And the Buddha isn't part of that. He isn't afraid of him. He isn't responding with fear or aggression. And he says something which is very touching. He says, "At last, a greatly revered one has come to the forest for my sake." Someone cares about him. He's seen that the Buddha cares about him. And in some way, this breaks through the whole identity that Angulimala has created of this fearsome warrior, bandit, killer, who everyone respects because of his martial prowess. The Buddha cares about him. Someone he respects, because he's a greatly revered one, cares about him. And Angulimala changes. From that point on, he asks to become a follower of the Buddha. He becomes a monk. And eventually, he becomes enlightened. So I want to just pause with the story. I'm going to come back to another element of it. The Buddha turns to Angulimala. He doesn't have to go into the forest, but he's very willing to. And there are many stories in the Buddha's life of him being willing to go to meet the demons, to meet the spirits, to meet the dark forces that live in the forest. And Angulimala is one of them. He's very much a demonic force. And Angulimala, in the end, turns to the Buddha. Or perhaps we should say he turns to himself. He's willing to look at himself. He recognizes what the Buddha tells him, that there's something going on in his emotional experience that needs his attention. And that is the only thing, really, that's important. The Buddha says, stop. And one thing I found in working with people in prison and coming out of prison is when people... I don't wish prison on anyone, although I also don't wish wandering freely in society on some people either. I don't wish that on society. And what I have found with lifers, people who've committed a murder and have been in prison for a long time, is that The prison walls have said, stop. You can't act out your aggression. You can't walk through that door once it's closed. And I'm not advocating this as a sort of form of rehabilitational therapy in itself, but it clearly has an effect. People who've been in prison for very long periods of time, they often sober up. They grow older. Most crime is committed by people between 18 and 25, young men. By the time they're 35 or 40, they're a different person. They're a person who's been told, stop. So we don't need prison walls to do that. Life tells us to stop. We go on in our habits, our patterns. If they really get out of hand, and then you end up in prison, that's where you meet someone like me. Meditation, in a way, says stop. It says don't move. It says the thought comes, don't follow it. And we might put that in gentler terms, but that's the underlying message. We say notice it, acknowledge it, and gently bring the mind back. But we're not going with our tendencies. So just as the Buddha says to Angulimala, stop. That's what we say to ourselves with whatever tone of voice we can muster. It says don't act on our impulses, our physical or mental impulses. The psychology behind this in Buddhism is, the key term is what we call proliferation, and noticing how our minds go from a simple experience to a much more complex experience. So we're walking around the field, someone looks at you in a way that seems a bit strange. We don't like that. It's unpleasant. Why did he look like? Then we start to think. I actually had quite a few conversations just in the last couple of days with people about like that. What's going on with that person? Why do they look at me like that? What's all this about? We proliferate. And so eventually, things become complex. Our proliferations become habits. Buddhism, if you know Buddhist psychology, you'll know the term sanskara. So that's when one of those proliferating tendencies has become a habitual thing we do, a coping mechanism, if you like. And we get move further and further away from the simple elements of our experience, which are liking things, wanting to be happy by getting more of them, not liking things, wanting to avoid suffering. We get further and further away from those simple elements of us as human beings with emotions, with responses, into something where we get lost, or our coping mechanisms take over our lives. Our coping mechanism might be worry to fend off the threats that we envisage. It might be depression, which grows from ruminating about what's wrong with me, essentially. It might be stress, which is about tensing up and gathering the kind of adrenaline and cortisol that we need in order to manage the challenges that face us. It might be alcohol, it might be drugs, it might be violence, it might be being an irritating person or an irritable person, or even an irritating person, you know, etc. We all have our ways of coping with life. And this is all, for Buddhism, this is all prapancha. This is all proliferation from some quite simple, more visceral experiences. Mindfulness is about noticing how proliferation takes hold. It's about coming back to those elements of our experience that are simpler and more, where we don't get lost in the complexity. Simpler emotions, simpler impulses, simpler liking and disliking. So that's the simplicity at the heart of Buddhism. We let our experience be what it is without, and when things do feel very complicated, mindfulness, I think, is asking us to pose a particular question, which is, what's simple here? What's feels like something I can understand. I can experience right now in this moment. So, in all these examples, what we're talking about fundamentally is the mind. If we were having a public policy discussion about the terrorist problems we're facing in Shravasti, the ancient Indian problem, the ancient Indian city where the Buddha lived, we would analyze the causes of the radicalization of these bandit murderers and so on and so forth. And we would engage in a kind of abstraction, probably. There's nothing wrong with abstraction, but mindfulness is helping us to be aware of the emotional reality, the experiential reality behind that abstraction. Mindfulness is coming into our society in many ways, and it's asking, many of us are learning practices like meditation that help us stay with simpler parts of our experience, help us to access states of calm, help us to notice prapancha, proliferation, as it develops, let go of that, get to know our patterns, our habits, our impulses that lead us again and again into prapancha. That's how I see fundamentally the work that we're doing as I'm doing as a mindfulness teacher, going in schools, prisons, parliament, wherever. We talk about that in these secular contexts as therapy, as a therapeutic intervention, as stress management, as attention training, as well-being. And that's all fine. That's the language of the settings into which we're taking mindfulness. But personally, I think it's important that we don't identify mindfulness as a therapy, a well-being intervention, a stress management technique, because what we're dealing with is the mind. The mind is dangerous. The mind is mysterious. The mind is powerful. It has powers of which we are not aware. Some of those powers are transformative and healing and sacred. And that's what we are most have to offer in all of these settings. I used to talk about the work of teaching mindfulness outside Buddhist contexts as secular mindfulness. And I noticed that Buddhists often do that to distinguish what happens in those settings from what happens in a more explicitly Buddhist setting. The group of people who are working with Parliament had a meeting with Jon Kabat-Zinn, who is the founder of Mindfulness-Based Stress Reduction, which is the kind of packaging of mindfulness and meditation that has led to all of this mindfulness movement. And in that conversation, I used the word to him, secular mindfulness, and he was on me like a flash. We have to be careful how we language here, is what he said to me. If there's something called secular mindfulness, there's something called sacred mindfulness. It's just mindfulness. So I had to go away and think about this. And I realized that calling something secular mindfulness is just, it's just a word. The mind is neither isn't secular or Buddhist. The mind is the mind. You can call the mind sacred, but unfortunately, I do sometimes use that. But I'm also aware that once we use the word sacred, we set up an opposition with profane. So I would only use the word sacred if we're in the sense that everything is sacred, as opposed to only these things in this special setting are sacred. Everything is sacred. Mindfulness-based cognitive therapy is sacred. The .B program is sacred. Because I'm going to stop using the word sacred, actually. It's a bit too problematic, but it indicates the kind of power that I think we need to be aware of when we take mindfulness into those places. And just one other thing about Jon Kabat-Zinn that I found very helpful. He recently made a comment about what he was doing in teaching mindfulness. And people are asking, are you teaching about attention? Are you teaching about Buddhist mindfulness? He says, look, when I talk about mindfulness, I'm not talking about mindfulness. I'm not talking about the one part of the Buddhist path that we call sati or smriti, and there are other words as well, which is the mind's capacity to know itself. I'm talking about the whole Buddha Dharma, the essential element of the whole Buddha Dharma. So that's what Kabat-Zinn said. And again, that gave me great pause. Is that really what we're doing? Is that what we're doing in nuggetry form? And if so, what is that nugget? And from what I gather from what Kabat-Zinn was saying, and from what I've come to believe, the nugget is the mind's capacity to transform itself, the mind's capacity to transform our experience. The mind's capacity, Angulimala's capacity to do that, to know himself, to see himself as if a mirror had been held up before him, and to become a different person, to be reborn, to let go of his hatred, but also his craving. Mindfulness does stand for something. It's that it's quite broad. I don't know if we can even tie it down in Buddhist doctrinal terms. It's the mind's capacity to know, the mind's capacity to change. I want to tell you a couple of stories to illustrate this. No, I'll just tell you one story. It's a story about someone who came on a course with me a couple of months ago. I'm teaching a whole series of, in total, 10 courses for people on probation. I'm also teaching courses for people in prisons, for prisoners and for prison staff. And this together makes 3 combined randomized controlled trials. So I'm very busy doing all of this. I just teach 5-minute meditations for people at the beginning of these courses. That is enough. And sometimes it's too much, actually, I can't imagine. So 5 minutes. We did one of them at the beginning. I talked. We interacted. I did another 5 minutes. And after the second 5 minutes, he said, that is the most peace I've experienced in the last 30 years. So I was privileged to witness someone go through a process of transformation week by week. The material was, if you're a mindfulness teacher, you'll know it, although it's adapted in this setting, about knowing your thoughts. And he described what it's like for someone in his situation to go into a shop. When you leave the shop, you're paranoid. That because, although he had a receipt in his hand, which he's holding, and a shopping bag in the other hand, you think you're going to be arrested for stealing and you're going back to prison. But he was watching his thoughts, watching himself tell that story and letting go of the thoughts. The next week we did something on self-compassion. In criminal justice settings, I use material that, well, I won't go into the background, but it's very direct. Usually when we're teaching MBSR, MBCT, these messages are implicit. You don't judge yourself, that's kind. But in prison, I get people, and on probation, I get people to say to themselves, first thing, this is my time on earth. This is the only life I have. Whatever I feel is okay. I can let go of my thoughts and be okay. I am a good person. I am worthy of love and respect. And we repeat those phrases to ourselves. So I taught that practice to the group. And at the end of it, he was dumbfounded. He said he found it very difficult to tell himself that what he felt was okay and that he was a good person. that he was worthy of love and respect because of what he'd done. And we had a dialogue, which is where this mindfulness teaching can take us. A dialogue which sometimes it happens in these settings, sometimes it doesn't. A dialogue which is really soul talk, where someone is talking from their soul and we respond from our soul and we meet. It's actually too powerful for me to talk about easily. So, slightly change tack. The Buddha was once asked by the inhabitant of a town who was a follower of the Buddha, who wanted to convert the other people in the town, it was the town of Nalanda, to Buddhism. He said, please, could you perform a miracle? Could you show some of your supernormal powers? Because the Buddha was said to have 10 supernormal powers, the ability to read minds, the ability to become big, to become small, all these sorts of things. There are stories about the Buddha performing miracles. And the Buddha said, and holy men in India were expected to perform miracles. Some of them still do. And the Buddha said, it is not fitting for a holy one, a worthy one, to display miraculous powers. The only thing that is worthy to do, the only miracle that is worthy to perform, is when someone, it's when you help someone to let go of anger and hatred and to become free from anger and hatred. That is the only miracle. So we could take that as a kind of dismissal of miracles, but I don't take it as a dismissal of miracles. I take it as an espousal of the what for the Buddha was the true miracle. The true miracle of changing ourselves, as Angulimala changed. And when you see that, you feel you are in the presence of something miraculous. And maybe you've had that experience in your life. You tapped the hidden, sacred, healing power of the mind that was there all the time. You allow yourself, you access that. You access it in small ways by noticing that your mind has wandered and learning to bring it back. You access it by noticing that you have a very critical self-commentary in your experience and letting it go and bringing a more kindly sense of awareness. That's what we're doing at MBCT. And that can be miraculous. In the sense that we're touching that power. And there is no limit to that power to transform us. That's why I don't talk about secular mindfulness, because I don't want to limit what we're engaging with. The context might limit it. Expectations might limit it. When people are doing things in their workplaces, the interactions between them and the boss who's also sitting there might limit what can happen. But if we're dealing with the mind, really fundamentally there are no limits. So just to round off, there's another bit of the Angulimala story, which is puzzling. When a Buddhist monk is asked for a blessing for a pregnant woman in Theravadan Buddhist countries, they recite something called the Angulimala Parita. Parita means blessing. So the Angulimala Parita is verses connected with Angulimala. And how amazing, how extraordinary it is that the way you bless a pregnant woman is through verses that are connected with a murderer. And the story goes, I'll just say this briefly. So the story is that Angulimala went into town on a begging round, because that's what people That's what Buddhist monks did, and in some ways still do. So he had to beg for his food from the populace. This was a populace who had lost their brothers, their sisters, their fathers to him. He'd killed them. So again and again, the Buddha told him, you've got to go on that begging round. Again and again, he was abused, he was vilified, and people threw things at him. They threw stones at him. He came back to the Buddha again and again. And the Buddha kept saying, you've got to keep doing this. This is how you purify your karma. And it's not bad for someone like that to feel regret, to feel remorse, to feel bad about what they've done. But there needs to be a faith that will help them through that. In fact, it's really important to feel remorse. Then one day, Angulimala, on his begging round, sees, in the Pali it says, he sees someone, a woman, having a breech birth, a cesarean operation. And it's a very painful, bloody sight that he sees. And maybe the baby will live, maybe they won't. And he comes to the Buddha and he says, there is so much suffering in the world. And the Buddha pauses and he says, you go back. And you say these words to this woman. Sister, since I was born with the noble birth, I do not recall that I have intentionally deprived a living being of life. By virtue of this truth, may you and your infant be well. And those are the words, and I'm going to recite them in Pali in a moment just to finish off. But those words have a healing power, a blessing power in Theravadan Buddhist countries, because Angulimala transformed himself so profoundly. He touched that healing power of the mind that made him turn from a murderer into a saint. He became an arahant, and if you go to Shravasa, you'll see his stupa. And that is that has a power, that has this healing and blessing power. It goes like this.
Yato ham bhagini aryaya jatiya jato nabijanami sanchicha panam jivita varopeta tena sachena sotite hotu soti gabasa.
Three times.
Yatoham bhagini aryaya jatiya jato nabijanami sanchicha panam jivata varopeta tena sachena sotite hotu soti gabasa. Yatoham bhagini aryaya jatiya jato nabijanami sanchicha panam jivata varopeta tena sachena sotite hotu soti gabasa.